Well, I'm at the age where anything I remember is a good memory, no matter how bad it was. And I have this very crystal clear memory of me being an upper class person in my art school. Had a clay studio. There was only four of us in it. And I was making all of these sculptures of bodies, human bodies that were heavily textured. They looked like they were covered in tattoos from top to bottom. And they had all kinds of body parts, both male and female together. And my teacher, who was a guy's guy, he walks to the door one day, walks by, he looks in and he goes, "Those are hermaphrodites." He walked off in, may I interpret it, as disgust, and he never walked in the studio that year again. He sent another teacher to do all our critiques. Now, my work was an exploration of complex identities. I was exploring. I wanted to understand all those places, those spaces in between that now we thank God have a name for, those queer spaces. But in those days, we did not. And my work was smashed on the floor, thrown into the woods once, and definitely bought more than once and returned because it was too disturbing to live with it at home. But this was all better, much, much better than what happened when I tried to express my identity explorations in my body, in my physical, personal identity art. Now, all of you know that in high school, we all discover, maybe junior high now, I mean, or middle school, whatever you call it now, that we all discover that we are all identity artists. And you all get to discover that it's a tribal, it begins with the tribe. And as a anthropology student, I learned that this is true all over the world, but let's just go to whatever your school was. I bet you there were, you knew how to dress. And in my school, they called it hoods. We were jocks, hoods, or there was this kind of thing that used to be beatniks and turned into hippies, but we were just the artsy ones at that point. And so you tried on these different identities and they worked or they didn't work. And I ended up in the artsy identity. Now, this is like 1965. So there was a form, you know, art, you have this inner side and you've got to turn it inside out. So you have to make it into a form of identity art. And this is the day, you know, before tattoos and piercings, but you know, some primitive cultures, when you're adolescent, that's exactly, you'd have a tattoo put on or a piercing. In those days, what we, and it was gendered, so female, I had very short skirts, very colorful tights, everything clashed, very bright colors, and everybody, at least at school, knew exactly what that meant. The only person deeply disturbed by this was my mother, who somehow thought that mixing prints and plaids together somehow, or even black and brown, was going to destroy my health. But and that worked. But then there's the third equation in all of art. In all art forms, there's the inner that you're turning inside out with form, some kind of form. And then there's the people who look at it, hear it, whatever your art form is, and they have to receive it. They have to, if you actually want them to get what you're communicating, you have to be part of a tradition, a vocabulary in your culture. And you can only change it slowly or they don't get it. So when I took that identity that I thought I had worked out very artistically and beautifully, and I took it out into the big city, into the wider streets, there were whole populations of people who read it differently. those signs meant something else to them, and I was often, repeatedly, and quite violently sexually harassed. You know, people grabbing at you in the streets. And I quickly learned that when something is not received, it brings up, like my art teacher, feelings of disgust or danger. Now, I personally felt both disgusted at the people who would grab at me and danger. And so I thought, I do not want to project this identity into the world. What I thought of as my true colors. No way. And so I entered into what one of my friends called my quite long camouflage period. For me, that was wearing boys' clothes, baggy, heavy boots, and lots of brown and blue. And I, you know, kind of worked on it until people did not notice me on the street at all. So because of that, it was so much better to make art and put all of this identity exploration in another art besides my personal body art. Now, of course, that was an artistic decision to dress in camouflage. And over the years, like in all of human history, we change how we look based on our roles and public identities in life. So, you know, me as the teacher, as the young mother, as the mother of children who could look at you and say, "Mom, don't you ever wear that in public while I'm with you." As the chaplain, the identities changed. I used to get my mother-in-law to go to the Episcopal Church rummage sale to buy me my chaplain clothes. You know, so it was like a costume that you had to have. But everybody knows, they can identify this in their lives, this public personal interaction of how you present yourself. It's an art form. And this identification of it with the stages of life is true, again, in every culture. Now, it might not be the same identifying visual symbols. You know, a widow in one country shaves her head and puts on white. The widow in another country might wear all black and cover her head. But there are still age-appropriate signals culturally in different lands. Now, I didn't think much about this for years. And then my youngest son was in junior high, or middle school, I guess you call it now, and he started experimenting with his identity. And I remember for about 3 months, he wore really cute little pigtails. And I'll tell you, I thought that kid had courage because nobody gave him positive reinforcement for this in school. He tried jewelry. Of course, he liked kilts because they were skirts. He tried different things. And the teachers were surprised. You know, "Oh, that kilt, I can't send you home. It looks okay." They would be very upset. But at the same time, I was on the guidelines committee of the UU, Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, where we deal with all the ethical issues in our profession. And one of our colleagues, who was a student then, came to me. Her name is Laurie Alphonse, and she said, "You know, we have this list of kind of people that we will protect in our congregations and in society as minorities that might be harassed or have unequal treatment. And on that list is gay and lesbian and bisexual, but there's nothing about being transgender." And this was in about 1993 or 4, and I went, "Transgender? What's that?" I'd never heard that word before. And so she graciously took on the project of educating me, and then we together educated the rest of our colleagues. We went through a two-year process where we sent out materials to everyone, where we voted to add them as a protected minority in our guidelines. And that has opened up that ministry as a career in our movement for people who self-identify as transgender. During that time, part of the education was to really understand where this dynamic of disgust and lack of safety comes from. And so we invited a cultural psychologist who worked for the Kinsey Institute to do a class for, actually, it was at our national UUMA meeting. And he was this lovely, gorgeous man. He had long black hair and incredible jewelry, lots of earrings. And he told us that he grew up, his mother was from a southwestern tribe of indigenous people, but his father was from one of the northwestern tribes. And then those tribes, you know, where they have the totem poles and stuff, he said it was a very class-based society. And he dressed like a high-class man. And then he showed us pictures from all over the world of cultures that he had studied, both indigenous and then more what we would think of as historical, and showed us how they signified visually gender, male and female. Every culture he went to had some way to visually identify male and female. A few had a way to signify someone who was neither, a third gender. What was interesting is they were so different as the fact that he had long hair and earrings meant male in his culture, and that if I have long hair and earrings, it would mean female in our culture. The only thing that was similar across cultures, almost more than similar, almost exactly the same, was when people in any culture would look at someone that they could not identify what gender they were, in less than half a second, they felt anxious, moving to disgust very quickly. The reptilian part of our brain needs to categorize male and female. But that's just a brief response, a brief impulse. And so we're going to talk more, Megan's going to help, is going to take this on, where we're going to talk more about how that brief impulse, like all of human experience, can move on to reflection, creativity, and ways to create a personal art that can be received that once seemed disgusting. Hit it, Megan.
Thank you. So we have our lizard brain, right? We have this holdover from when crossing lines and crossing boundaries might get us killed, when our tribes would protect us and keep us safe, but only if we followed the rules. And it's part of how we evolved. It's always there. We're not going to get rid of it. So how do we deal with it? Like Gail said, how do we make it useful? How do we use it to help us? So what I'm going to share with you is one of my biggest encounters with my lizard brain and what made me go, I'm not sure that I can do this. It's the story of how I came to shave my head. So a couple of years ago, I'm a full-time seminary student. I have two part-time jobs. I have two small children. I'm commuting multiple hours a day, and I'm just stretched so thin. And at the time, one of the jobs that I had, I worked with a lot of veterans from the military who had maintained their shaved heads when they got out and came back home. And I started finding myself thinking, oh God, I wish I could do that. That would be amazing. That would just, it would make my life easier. It would feel great. When you live in Los Angeles, you sweat in January. It's like 90 degrees. And then I realized I can do that, but only if I'm willing to deal with how the people around me will read me, what signals I'm sending them that maybe don't match who I am. So I did it, obviously. And it was amazing. It was amazing. I was at lunch with my family. There was a fantastic Sam's next door, and I walked in and I said, take it all off. And she said, what? I said, take it all off. She said, zero setting? Really? You don't just want a little bit? I was like, no, get rid of it. And then I had to go back outside onto the street. And I felt great, but people would call me names. You know, they'd yell dyke as if that's a bad thing. At my multi-faith seminary, when I went back to class, people assumed that I'd converted to Buddhism all of a sudden. It's one of the joys of my seminary. So regardless of how positive or negative the reaction was, however, not a single day went by that I wasn't asked, why did I shave my head? While men walked by with shaved heads that no one noticed. And the absolutely hardest reaction for me to deal with has been the folks who think I'm sick, who think that I have cancer. Because in their reading of what women should and shouldn't look like, only women who have cancer shave their heads. And yet this assumption that they have put on me comes from their sense of connection, their overwhelming desire to reach out and help someone in need. They are my best teachers when it comes to navigating this art of identity, of creating oneself, because they constantly remind me that cultural readings are about humanity. And that while the effect of these categories and labels are often harmful, the intent behind them is often not about harm at all. And the more we are each willing to create our outsides to match our insides, the more that we turn our inner art outward, the better we understand how to make sure the effects our actions have on others matches our intentions. We give each other the benefit of the doubt that way. And it also works in reverse. So while my intent in shaving my head was personal, it was self-ish, the effect has been to chip away at these cultural assumptions and readings just by walking out my front door. Now, I want to be really clear here that this act of shaving my head has a lot of privilege holding it up. I'm white, which unfortunately our current culture pervasively makes the norm to the extreme detriment of people of color. I have reliable access to clean clothes in good repair, and I'm taller and heavier than most people, which makes me less likely to be physically attacked when I'm out on the street. I'm serious. I'm the one people ask to walk them to their cars at night. When people do lash out at me because of my identity art, because I make their lizard brain anxious and make them feel disgust, they use words. The various ways in which my body has privilege protects me in a way that is denied to most of the trans community, especially trans persons of color. Especially when they act to bring their inner and outer selves into harmony. All I had to do to keep this going was to buy a $20 electric razor. Those who wish to transition to bring their inward self and outward self into right relationship face huge costs in terms of money and time and emotional bandwidth. Surgery can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Hormone regimens, the same. And under our healthcare system, that's a cost that never goes away. It's for the rest of their lives. Legal fees pile up. Even the price of an entire new wardrobe can be cost prohibitive. And transitioning itself, this holy creative act, can often lead to the loss of the job that was paying for the transition. Because firing someone for being trans is still legal in most of this country. And those who live as trans, regardless of how or when they choose to transition, often find themselves at the mercy of a world built upon the fallacy of binary gender being inextricable from one's sex assigned at birth. Now, in your order of service today, we have given you the gender-bred person infographic, which can give you, thank you. Which can give you a kind of better idea of what we're talking about when we say that these things are extricable from each other, and that you can choose to weave the different parts of yourself, that the sex you were assigned at birth may not match how you identify as your gender or how you express it. So while I am what they call cisgender, I'm comfortable in that my gender identity matches what I was assigned at birth, with this head, my presentation's a little queer. So look at the lines and figure out in the coming days where you might fall on the slider. And it's okay to move back and forth depending on how you feel every day. But we'll get to that in a bit. What I'd like to share with you now is the story of Shadi Petoskey, who just a few days ago was detained by TSA agents at the Orlando airport. She's a trans woman, and because a body scanner only has two settings, a blue button for male and a pink button for female, I wish I were kidding, her penis showed up as an anomaly. They held her in a room and questioned her for almost an hour. She missed her flight. American Airlines charged her full price to rebook her ticket. It was almost $1,000. She was denied her new boarding pass until a police officer ordered them to print it for her. And every time I revisit this story, and you can hear I'm angry, I followed how both the TSA and American Airlines are attempting to gaslight her in her story despite her photographic evidence of what happened to her. And at the same time, I'm overwhelmed with gratitude for that police officer. It's a sign for me that change has already taken root in our culture. Because the trans community has historically had as much to fear from police and other first responders who were supposed to protect them as the ones attacking them. Our call to worship this morning spoke of those among us here who are hurt and afraid, those who come with hope and anticipation, those who seek to learn, all of them, all of us, a family here together. Reverend Gale taught us about the tribe, that fundamental element that came along with the lizard brain, that shows its members how to belong, how to be safe. And through our new member celebration this morning, we are reminded that we are a tribe, one that calls people to belong because of our diversity, our beautiful diversity, and not in spite of it. The trans community lives in fear of poverty and abuse and violence. These things happen to our members and our friends, to their loved ones and our loved ones. Out there, beyond these walls, more often than not, they have to choose between being seen or being safe. In here, as part of our community, we see them. We see you. You are us. What happens to you happens to us. We cannot be whole until you are whole. And the more we all choose to embrace the holy act of creating ourselves, of being identity artists, the safer we can make it for those around us. Shaving my head, in comparison, is such a small thing, but it might have made living in this world just a little bit easier for someone who doesn't conform to expectations, whether they consider themselves to be trans or not. Wholeness is a constant creative process. We are not sculptures carved in stone. We are living beings with thoughts and feelings and ideas that change with every encounter. I am different every time I shake your hand. I am changed every time you offer me a smile. We are all creative people built on a relationship between the inside, what's here, and how we demonstrate it outside. Energy going back and forth and growing and evolving into our beautiful true selves with each other's help. How can we see you the way you need to be seen? How can we help you feel safe? What is your next holy act of creation? And what kind of tribe will we together create and recreate every day anew?